John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I welcome my colleague, Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Gregory is here to help us all understand the significance of the passing of Prince Philip, the royal consort, Elizabeth the Queen's husband for many decades. His passing marks the occasion one more time to speak of the greatest generation forged in the horror of the Second War. Prince Philip lived a full life in two cultures, one from the Mediterranean basin, another one from the Atlantic basin. He was born 10 June 1921, died 9 April 2021, being honored and mourned by the royal family. But, Gregory, a very good evening to you. Prince Philip was a significant figure for Queen Elizabeth, and that's heartwarming and heartbreaking at the same time because she goes on without him. He lived a full life at age 99, passing away at age 99. He was called the royal consort, and let's establish why he was never king. Why was he called royal consort and not king? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, a consort of a monarch, well, traditionally it would have been mostly females would be consorts to the kings. And there was no, if you like, downside in naming your wife, if you're a king, as queen, because the king was clearly going to be the lead figure, the sovereign. But when you are a sovereign queen, to have a consort named king would imply a level of equality. And even Queen Victoria, who arguably depended vitally on Prince Albert as her consort, still denied him his wish to be king consort. And it would have been king consort. It would never have been just king. And similarly, Queen Elizabeth made it clear to Prince Philip that he would be the prince consort, not the king consort, because the sovereign needs to be seen as sovereign, needs to be seen as supreme. Whereas if you're a king and a sovereign king, then having a queen as a supporting player, if you like, doesn't detract from the supremacy, if you like, of the crown.
The king, the royal consort was of Greek and Danish royal families. I came across him for the first time because he was active in the Royal Navy in the invasion of Sicily. He, in fact, served with distinction in the Mediterranean basin and in the Pacific. So he was a war hero representing the greatest generation. Of significance, however, he provided a continuity from my point of view, from observing from the outside, you know, a colonial who got away. His significance, however, was knitting together these cultures. And I know that Britain has a soft spot for Greece. Did Greece have a soft spot for Britain? Did the royal families of Greece and Denmark regard this marriage as significant for blending Europe together?
Well, there's no question. And in fact, you could argue that Prince Philip, although he was a prince of Greece and of Denmark, was also basically of German stock, as a lot of the British royal family has absorbed German blood over the years. So there was a great commonality between the royal houses of Europe, and the Greek royal house was one which had been adopted, if you like, late by European standards. And they brought in the royal lines of one of the German houses and of Denmark to create the modern Greek monarchy. So there was always this kinship, and Prince Philip and his family were always, shall we say, uber European. And so this was not an unusual blending. And it was, but although Prince Philip was also related to Earl Mountbatten of Burma, and Earl Mountbatten, of course, was the son Prince Louis of Battenberg, who changed his name to Mountbatten in World War One because Battenberg obviously had a German sound to it, because it was German, and Prince Louis, you know, wanted to prove that he was as first Sea Lord in the Royal Navy was quintessentially British, and so Earl Mountbatten, his son, was of course a great naval hero in his own right, and of course Commander in Chief in Southeast Asia during World War Two. And so, and he was an uncle to Prince Philip. So this was not a strange marriage at all, although because of the war, particularly, Prince Philip was somewhat lost for a home. And he was fortunate that he had joined the Royal Navy, was sent there for his training, in much the same way as we see members of the royal families of, particularly in the Middle East and so on, and even places like Brunei, would send their youngsters to Sandhurst, Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst in Britain, or to the Royal Naval College in the UK to do their training. And I had Chinese friends who were caught as doing their Royal Navy training in 1939, and the Royal Navy said, well, you're not going home, you're staying in the Royal Navy. And that's what happened to Prince Philip, of course, and he served with great distinction through the war. I was always aware of him throughout my life because he and Queen Elizabeth often visited Australia. I met him, of course, on a number of occasions, and he was a truly interesting character. You called him a war hero, and I don't believe that he's a war hero just because he participated in World War II, but he was genuinely a courageous person and acted with distinction in the Navy during World War II and acted with distinction subsequently. And if you like, his greatest courage came from the fact that he had to suppress his natural tendency towards leadership and to being outspoken and individualistic and an independent thinker. He had to really contain that because he knew that he was there to serve his wife as queen. And this is almost a schizophrenic role, if you like, for a strong man to serve his wife in such a public fashion. And yet he did so with incredible distinction. Yes, he made a number of moves which can be considered gaffes or outrageous comments and so on. But he really was an incredible public servant, loyal to the crown, loyal to Britain, loyal to the Commonwealth. Quite amazing.
I mentioned that his death at 99, it reminds me of Vera Lynn's death at 103. This is the greatest generation. This is a window. It's like a time machine to what they were when they were young. And yes. My father was born 21 and didn't live as long as Prince Philip. But they're completely different people than us, Gregory. It's worth reminding ourselves again. We're their children. We're not the same. Mm-hmm. Their values, their vision, their imaginations were discontinuous from ours. I guess that's the nature of being a successful generation. You're unique.
Yes, it is. Although I think that in the Commonwealth, one of the benefits of having this incredible continuity of a sovereign and a royal family that endures through all the political turmoils and the social turmoils is that you do get that sense of continuity and that linkage with the past. And I think this has been extremely valuable for Britain and extremely valuable for Commonwealth countries such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and so on, particularly, where we hold to these ideals of continuity with the past. And what we saw when Prince Philip retired from his royal duties in August 2017 was that at that point, we saw that click, that change to the next generation, which is absolutely critical. When Prince Albert died long before the death of Queen Victoria was in a state of depression for a long time, and that actually had acted as a pall on the nation. And it took some time for Queen Victoria to recover and for Britain to regain its sense of grandeur and global destiny. Now, with the passing of Prince Philip and his retirement 2 years ago, what we've seen is Queen Elizabeth has started moving the royal responsibilities now very, very much onto the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, who is acting in much more of a leadership role. He's always been doing it, but he was overshadowed. Now he's coming out into his own. And this is happening at just the right time. And by the way, Prince Philip was highly aware of this, and I think contributed to his decision to step down from official duties to enable Prince Charles to emerge, because Britain, after the Brexit vote of 2016, was clearly going to have to become the new global Britain, and it needed the new generation to do that. And Prince Charles is going to be able to, and is working in great harmony with this trend toward new global Britain. And the Queen stepping aside is helping that. The Queen has already made the arrangement that Prince Charles will be accepted and has been accepted by the Commonwealth as the next head of the Commonwealth, not just as a sovereign of the United Kingdom and sovereign separately, sovereign of Australia, Canada and New Zealand and other Commonwealth countries. But he is now starting to assume his real pivotal role in the continuity of British history.
I'm speaking with Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs editor and publisher. We're talking about the passing of Prince Philip. We're also talking about Great Britain itself, its vision of itself, global Britain. When we come back, we're going to speak of the idea of a nationalist assumption of power, what it means here in the United States, what it means to Britain and other parts of the empire, once upon a time, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.